it seemed apropos since Ted started off the afternoon that he's going to round out the afternoon. So I'm just going to pass the ball over to Ted.
Thank you very much. We're very lucky to have three folks from what I would call sophisticated organizations on the subject of obesity with very diverse but complementary experience for this closing panel. And I would encourage you guys to think of your toughest questions. Don't let these guys off easy. We're gonna do a little bit of an overview with Bruce and Trina and Susan about what's going on in Cleveland Clinic, at Kaiser, and at American Airlines. But then we're going to try and leave as much time as we can for some discussion, because we've been filling you up with stuff. We need to get some back from you. So our objectives are really to review these experiences, talk about the intersection of chronic disease prevention and obesity care, give you some insight into the complexity of obesity and wellness in the context of large organizations, and identify some key directions for the future. So from there, I'll hand it over to Bruce.
Thank you. We've heard a lot this afternoon, and actually there's so many things I would want to say to start off. One of the things, even before I started into my slide set, is the importance of this conversation this afternoon about obesity and obesity as a chronic disease. When we talk about return on investment for wellness programs, for weight management programs, for chronic disease programs like I'm going to go into, it is a lot more than just whether we're saving medical costs, although we clearly are down the line, but it's also about presenteeism, absenteeism, disability. I wear a lot of hats at the Cleveland Clinic, so I swap between an HR hat and a provider hat and an insurer hat, because my main job for the last 8 years has been chief medical officer of running the employee health plan at the Cleveland Clinic, which is sort of a pure insurance plan, but well integrated with our provider network. So we have a lot of advantages in what we can do to treat something like obesity. And we have had great success both in treating obesity and having our population reduce their weight, and actually also circling back around and saying that we've seen some cost savings, some decreased utilization, some improved quality from that. Unfortunately, our HR systems are lousy, so I can't say that we've done anything about presenteeism or absenteeism, but I wish I could. Real quick, because we're not a lot of time here, key facts about the clinic: we're large, almost 4,000 employed physicians, another 1,000 affiliated physicians out in the community, 52,000 employees, of which 14,000 are nurses and advanced practice providers. We're physician-led. We're self-insured for everything: our workers' comp, our disability, our group plan. So everything's in-house with us, which gives me some major advantages compared to some other employers. I don't really have to work with an insurance plan. I am the insurance plan. But a lot of what we do can be leveraged by an employer with a responsive, good relationship with their insurer. So, as I said, we're self-insured, 52,000 employees. We have about 105,000 covered lives on the plan right now, and that's our mission statement. And our challenges, starting about 10 years ago, is how to build a culture of wellness, really even a culture of population care for 52,000 employees and their families. How do we support their lifestyle choices? How do we promote some personal responsibility on their behalf? How do we use accurate, objective data so that we know that money we spend is being used in an efficient, biggest bang for the buck way? So we targeted, 10 years ago, six chronic conditions that in our health plan had a major impact. You can see them up there, and I've highlighted obesity in red. Why do we focus on obesity besides the fact that it can elevate cholesterol, elevate blood pressure, clearly leads to diabetes? It doesn't have much to do with asthma, but has quite a bit to do with other breathing difficulties and COPD. We focus on obesity because if we can reverse the trend of obesity in our population. Down the line, we will see and have seen reduced coronary artery disease, diabetes, congestive heart failure, COPD, cancers, joint replacements, hip, knee replacements. This, you know, it just goes on and on and on. So it's kind of the linchpin for a lot of different chronic diseases that we don't want our employees or their family members to have. That little bundle of cash is to represent one of the ways we handle this. We have really significant financial incentives for our employees and their family members to work with us. And you'll see later how significant incentives, not $50 or $100 gift cards, but actually significant amounts of money back in their paycheck, have managed to drive some behavior change. Even though it's an extrinsic motivator, it leads to intrinsic motivation once someone is actually changing their behaviors, changing their culture, and part of our program. We've already been through this, so I'm going to skip this, but basically, the overweight and obese population is a very expensive population because of all the morbidity that I just described it leads to. We're probably already, if someone did the analysis, at $1 trillion a year in direct and indirect obesity costs, particularly if you go beyond just medical care and go to that absenteeism and disability costs. It's already about $6,000 more per year in medical costs alone for a worker with a BMI above 40, which, by the way, far outweighs the increased medical costs for a smoker. We've also heard about this, but I love the graphic representation of whether we're actually having an obesity epidemic in the U.S. You're looking at 1990, 2000, and 2010. What you'll note is that in 1990, no single state had an adult obesity rate above 20%, 24%. By 2010, none of them were below 25%. Many were above 30%. By 2016, and I apologize because CDC changed the scales that they use, so the map looks different, but this is straight off the CDC. By 2016, we're talking about only Colorado, Massachusetts, and I think that's DC off in the corner, I can't see. They're below 25%. Most everyone is above 30%, and the Deep South is still above 35%. And this is interesting, because when we talk about obesity, we're also talking about cardiovascular health. This is resting heart rate by state. There's a particular trend there that you can see. It's almost a perfect match. Mm-hmm. The states with higher obesity levels have higher resting heart rates. Higher resting heart rates are, again, simply a measure of the extra cardiovascular burden that being obese puts on the cardiovascular system, eventually leading to high blood pressure, heart attack, stroke, and so forth. So what programs do we have that help members? We don't just focus on obesity, as you saw before. We focus on a number of different things. But for obesity, we have our own fitness centers that we own, that we run in our institutions, that are free to all members and their families, if any of us can convince a family member to actually come into the building and use our fitness center. We have Curves and Weight Watchers subsidized by the health plan. So we don't just offer Curves and Weight Watchers, we actually pay for a significant chunk of it. We've handed out 35,000 devices that link to our online portal so that anybody who wants one can start to track their exercise and their steps to improve their health. Busy slide, but what we do for weight management is basically as follows. We incentivize it, and I'll describe that in a little bit. We set an annual weight loss target for the members that join our program in conjunction with the member and their primary care physician. The targets are set based on the prior year, so we don't allow yo-yoing. You can't keep gaining and losing the same 10 pounds to get the very large premium discount that we're giving our members. We use the EMR for communication and our online portal for communication with both members and providers, so we're constantly updating and informing both those groups. We use phone and email as well to reach out to the providers that are not on our EMR. We use our claims as well as clinical data and the fitness tracker databases, all accessed as needed, so that the health coaches that are working with each of the folks that have joined this program have the data that they need to work with the member. And one of the key elements of what we do, it's not just incentivizing our members and their families to work on weight loss. It's not just giving them a smorgasbord of different options that they can choose, whether Weight Watchers curves, shared medical appointments, telemedicine visits, online weight loss strategies, nutritionists, dietitians, on and on and on. We have probably 45 different things that they could do, all of which are free to them, no financial barriers. But we also assign each of them an individual coach that works with them on an ongoing basis. And I think that's one of the key elements to getting people to really change their behavior. We use stages of readiness to change and motivational interviewing. The point of this slide is just that all of our coaches are very well trained in how to do what they do. We do push the wearables because we do want to encourage healthy folks, whether or not they're overweight or standard regular weight, to get regular exercise and regular fitness activity. And we had trouble for years because initially we were giving money for people to self-enter activity data on the online portal. Let me tell you, when you're offering $1,400 a year back in people's pockets, it's not a good idea to have them enter their own activity data. Health risk appraisal, it's not a good idea to accept what they say they weigh and how tall they are either when you've got large amounts of money tied to it. So we stick with objective data, whether that's BMI data, body fat analysis data, and the activity data. So we finally gave out wearable fitness trackers that linked in, and we were very successful. I know I'm going fast, but simple to wear, cost efficient, communication, easy to use, and make it fun. So our online portal allows people to enter challenges with each other, form teams, compete against one another. A lot of people in the healthcare industry happen to be highly competitive to begin with, so they really enjoy that. I have one physician who, if she's not at the top of the leaderboard, continuously gets very upset and emails me. And our enrollment in these programs, not just weight, but all of the programs, have gone from about 1,000 members to about 16,000 members. That's what significant financial incentives will do. For weight management, those that only have a weight issue, that is 9,000 of the 16,000. So more than half of the folks that are enrolled have weight only. Now obviously, a lot of the diabetics have weight, a lot of the hypertensive have weight. So many of the others have weight as well. Probably 12,000 of the total of 16,000 that are enrolled have a BMI greater than 27. For the various diseases, we have achieved enrollment rates of, For the various diseases, we have achieved enrollment rates of 70% for diabetes and asthma, about 50% for weight. The weight is a harder sell. And our biggest problem, as was mentioned earlier, is that a lot of our most obese patients are in the lower socioeconomic classes, whom you would think would jump at the chance to get a 30% premium discount. And yet they are reluctant to join the program. So we're working on new sets of incentives for them beyond just the financial, new ways of communicating with them. But we're about 50% of every person in the health plan, whether an employee or a spouse, is enrolled in a weight management program with a health coach. 50% of all those with a BMI over 27, which I think is fairly impressive. It's actually 22,000 who have a BMI greater than 27, and I lied, it's 49%, not 50%, sorry. 10,824 are enrolled. That was 2017 data. So what are the results? This is interesting. If you look at the total weight in pounds gained or lost by that population with a BMI over 27, that's our target population, you'll see that about 25,000 people are losing about 25,000 pounds each year. So it's only about a pound per person. But most people don't lose weight year over year over year. Most people gain weight year over year over year. So to take 25,000 people with a BMI over 27 and on average have them all lose on average 1 pound a year, year after year, because we don't allow the yo-yoing, is pretty good. This is for the entire population, not just those enrolled in the program. If you just look at the ones enrolled in the program, you can see right away, they're the blue. People in the program are having a bit more success at losing weight than people not in the program. The ones not in the program are losing about a half a pound a year. The ones in the program are losing about 2 to 3 pounds a year. So this tells me that the money we're putting into the program is worthwhile. And the ones that are getting the full 30% discount are losing 14 to 15 pounds a year. When we look at our actual healthcare costs, we've been very successful with all of the chronic disease management programs. When we look at our utilization, we've been very successful. Huge drops in the diabetic and asthmatic population. You don't see huge utilization drops in the obese population in the first 2 or 3 or 5 years, but you do start to see it after 8 or 10 years. For employers, the problem is that's 8 or 10 years, maybe the same employee is not with you. So what's working for us? Financial incentives work great. Coaching and tracking of progress to goals works great. Fitness trackers, bariatric surgery, which we cover, works great. But we don't have a lot of programs that are proven to work. In fact, we're a test bed. The clinic has 45 different programs they think work on weight loss. We pilot them with 100 or 200 members to see what happens. Sometimes they work, sometimes they don't. We pick and choose which ones we're willing to cover. And we need all the physicians to manage it like a chronic disease with referrals and follow-up. Key messages, and I think that's it.
Great. Thank you. Good afternoon, everybody. I'm Trina Histon from Kaiser Permanente, and I'm thrilled to be here. Thank you to the meeting organizers for asking me to be here. First of all, I'll tell you a little bit about Kaiser Permanente, and I brought my paper copy in case this acts up, just in case. We're the largest healthcare, integrated healthcare system in the United States. I'd say 80% of our business footprint is in California, and you can see there on the map where we exist. And we're unique in that we're the health insurance side and we're also the provider side. In terms of looking at what factors that shape health, I'm sort of going to thread through lessons learned. I've been working in the topic of obesity since 2001 for Kaiser Permanente, and we've evolved our strategy and we've also evolved the places where our strategy shows up. So in a way, it's almost like a permeable cell wall where when we learn what happens in care delivery, we're making sure that flows into our own workforce and that also flows into our wellness strategies that we develop and partner with groups like you all. In addition to where we put our community benefit and investment dollars, because as a not-for-profit, we have the ability to do that and all of that to shape sort of healthy food and healthy activity environments. So this has been a long journey that started actually with our bariatric surgeons who were saying, you know, we're seeing more and more patients who are wanting bariatric surgery back in the early 2000s. And Kaiser Permanente, what's our strategy going to be that has both prevention and treatment as part of the portfolio? So if you look at this slide that came from data back in 2002, 10% of medical care contributes to health. The other 90% exists in your family history and genetics, which you can't do a lot about when you're born into it. The environment and social factors, we heard a lot about that in the previous panels, and we're learning more and more about social determinants of health and how they're impacting. And then about 40% are in personal behaviors. And all of these issues sort of interact with each other and give us an ability to positively impact those drivers of health. But we've learned as a system that we started with our medical care program, but we very quickly realized that somebody earlier in a panel quoted how many thousands of hours there are in a year, and then how many you are in the doctor's office. So obviously you want to make sure you're leveraging those hours in all the places that you're in. So I would say, and maybe I'm running up against a sticky slide issue, we sort of see things as dimensions of influence. At the core there is our care model and the Permanente medicine. And so what are we doing in terms of prevention and treatment within our system? I'd say we're on a journey. We've done a lot of great things, and we're still on the journey. We still have a ways to go. What we've been able to do is flow through what's really working within the care model into our own workforce, because obviously our employees are spending their day delivering healthcare to 12 million members. So it makes sense for us to leverage a science base and be able to have it show up in our workforce. And I'll share a little bit about how we've done that in a moment. The other thing, obviously, that flows is our care model through the partnerships we develop with our employer groups and our purchasers and the coalitions that we work in, because the footprint we have isn't just claims data. We actually can take that real-time data and give that back to you in a timely fashion, then partner together on what's going to be the best plan for your employee population, if it's in an urban-rural divide or you have white-collar, blue-collar, or what have you. So making sure there's a diversity in the approach. I think we've heard from many speakers how complex obesity is, and I actually think of it as obesities, and I think we would do well to continue to push on that complexity. And then the last circle you'll see that we've done about 10 or 11 years' worth of work in is, if we invest dollars in communities, how do we best spend it to get to a dose of change? Many of you may sponsor, as your organizations, a 5K, a 10K, a fun run. Is that money, usually it's for brand and reputation, which is also a good idea for your company. But if you actually went to a park and sponsored a small workout area, you might reach fewer people, but the dose of what's going to happen there may actually lead to better health. So thinking about where you're putting those dollars, not just your health dollars, is something we've learned along the way that really can make a difference, and I'd be happy to share the publications on that concept of dose. So I show you this not just to sort of talk about all the ways that our members can receive care, but at the back of all of those ways to receive care is the data that we get. And I would say since the Affordable Care Act passed in 2010, the nature of how care delivered in the United States has fundamentally shifted. And what we've seen in addition to the ACA in 2010, and we're sort of 8 years in to it, for better or worse, whatever your opinions are on it, you know, we recognize too at the same time the electronic medical record was also rising in popularity and use. And that also means more sophisticated in-reach, outreach strategies from a care delivery perspective, but also to better support your employees. So we sort of have all of that data, and we're still in the midst of huge changes. More than 50% of how a patient accesses care in Kaiser Permanente is through their smartphone. So making sure we video visits and making sure a lot of phone visits, so it means they're not taking a day off to have their doctor's appointment, which I think is good news for everybody. Since I was talking to a coalition of healthcare purchasers, I thought that I should talk a lot about what we do for our own employees, because we didn't start out here. We had to learn our way through it. We had many, many years working in clinical care delivery. Then the community benefit layered on pretty quickly. We've evolved our strategy with employer groups. But I would say the healthy workforce work that we've done sort of came on forth and has evolved significantly. A lot of you have spoken today about the importance of culture change. And I would say in July, I celebrate my 20th anniversary with Kaiser Permanente. I'm from Ireland originally, if you couldn't tell, I have a bit of an accent. But we want to be the healthiest workforce in healthcare. And we can say that, but if our leaders aren't sort of behind us in that sort of vision, then we struggle, and you know this in your own experience. So we see many benefits. Obviously, that work culture and environment that enables employees to feel healthy, be present, is important. Obviously, reducing absenteeism and the costs associated with that. And then having our members see our employees be active, and I'll show you some pictures in a minute, also sends a message that it's not just healthcare, it's about health. I think somebody in the other panel talked about that. And really wanting to have that industry-leading approach to health and well-being. So we have a five-point strategy to sort of support that. And it is, as a person that isn't sort of the top line in the company, I'm kind of five steps away from the CEO, so not too bad in terms of degrees of influence, if you put it that way. Making sure our senior leaders really speak to and really talk about a healthy workplace. It's not just a box that's ticked on an annual review. I think the Healthy Workforce team has done a tremendous job of offering a diversity of programs to make it easier to make that sort of healthy choice and be healthy. Educating and engaging employees, engagement has been the word I walk away with today as being a very important one. And then having that reward and reinforcement, so we've also heard about incentives, and I'll share that. And then, very importantly, measuring those things. It's not enough just to say you're doing it. You know, how are you demonstrating that? So this is sort of our model of well-being, and I was really happy to see the financial wellness panel this morning, because that's something we're leaning into a lot in Kaiser Permanente. But all of these things are dimensions of well-being in our system, and making sure that we're addressing all of those is sort of part of our model for our employees. I'm going quickly because I want to leave lots of room for Q&A. So we decided, and we're in our second cycle of this total health incentive plan, and you'll see about 130,000 employees are eligible for it, that we would make it voluntary, so it's not a punitive thing. You don't get dinged if you don't meet the marks at the end of a year. And we also decided that we'd make it on the collective, so we do it together. And so it's not necessarily just based on individual results. And there are two components to it. One is, and you probably already know this, that healthcare employees often take care of everyone else first, and then they might forget about themselves. So making sure that employees who are taking care of patients also have their health screenings up to date. This included smoking status, BMI, blood pressure, and also some of the cancer screenings. And so there's a payout for meeting that gate, as well as payouts for health improvements. So just to kind of give you some sense, in our first pass, we wanted to make people aware of what their issues were. So we had a total health assessment. So they were able to see, you know, where what's my health picture looking like? And so 76,000 employees completed that. And then 90% of the patient, of our employees actually did the health screening. So the payout on that alone was $40 million. And the actual full number for the health improvements was higher. So having enough diversity in what you're doing and how you're doing it leaves sort of an entry point for anybody to come in. And that, well, we thought was important. So here are some of the ways we do this. So on the top, my top left-hand side, which I'm assuming is the same as you, you'll see employees are out in one of the parking lots in one of our medical office buildings, and they're doing an instant recess. This is a 5 to 7 minute physical activity break during the day. And so our members are seeing, you know, folks with their Thrive t-shirts on doing this, and they're probably going, what the heck are they doing? But then when they're asked about their exercise vitals, as we take their blood pressure and their temperature, it sort of reinforces that we care about health, that we care about our own, and we care about yours. Thrilled at the last panel to look at diabetes risk. This is something we've started to do in this current cycle. And I'll ask forgiveness from the CDC folks that I've called it DPP. So don't tell Anne Albright, please, because we chat with Anne regularly. But really looking at reducing risk for diabetes is an important one. Sometimes finding an entry point, like I would say build your own salad is one of the most popular things we do, because people won't pay money for something they've never eaten before. But if somebody brings it in for the salad, they're like, what's that? Like for me, I didn't know what a pomegranate was. We didn't really have them in Ireland when I was growing up. And so now, of course, I love them because I've had them. But it gives you an ability to try things you'd never buy yourself and then share the recipes. And it's a real social bonding experience. And then the other one I'll mention is the pound for pound challenge. And this is usually around after the holidays, where it's traditional, where people want to lose some weight. And then we take those pounds and actually deliver it in food to food banks. So we sort of convert the pounds lost to food and then deliver it to food banks. So again, it's that maybe you mightn't do it for yourself, but you'll think about doing it for someone else. So I'm going to keep moving because I don't want to take up all of the time here. Culture is very important, and we've been on the journey of changing culture. These are some of the sample questions we have in our annual survey to our employees. And these are just the culture of health questions. There's a broad array of, you know, do you have the resources to do your job, et cetera, et cetera. And so we feel, back to that measurement and management, are we making a difference in these questions? And we've had them for a number of years now. And so what I can share with you is, you know, we are seeing, as we have positive changes in the culture of health score, that we've better attendance rates, fewer workplace injuries, less voluntary turnover, and improved quality. So it all matters. It's like a complex set of threads that make that final fabric you want to make something from. But it's complex and complicated. So I think my next slide is my last slide. And these are sort of those lessons learned. I think our journey has been aligning across all of our settings. So whether you're frontline care delivery or whether you're in corporate Are you sort of able to understand the assets that are available to you to be healthy? And they shouldn't really be different because you're receiving the care from Kaiser Permanente. I think it's important to say addressing prevention and treatment. I don't think if we think of a 70% prevalence of overweight and obesity in the United States that we're just going to prevent our way. And I think Ted said that very eloquently earlier. Having that welcome sign on for everyone, it doesn't matter where you're starting, there's a place for you. And you're welcomed no matter if it's your 10th time sort of coming back. And having a diversity in those program offerings that you're actually refreshing, whether it's seasonal, but being strategic about the layers you're adding, that they are evidence-based, and that they're bringing people in and keeping excitement going. I think the culture of health is key. We've certainly learned that from both the sort of the bottom up and the top down, and really meeting in the middle around that. Leaning into the complexity of obesities, it is more than calories in and out. It's also the quality of those calories. I think our previous speaker spoke about that, and I sort of like to think of it as we've got two brains. We've the one up here and the one that lives in our gut microbiota. And we're outnumbered 10 to 1 with that bacteria. And what's fascinating about the emerging research, and we're learning a lot from post-bariatric patients, actually. So if you test the microbiome of a patient going for surgery, there's one bacteria that rules them all. It's like a Game of Thrones, or I'm thinking of Tolkien, actually, at that. And after bariatric surgery, even days after, you see much more diversity in the gut. So we know there's a connection between the diversity in the gut and health. And I think the previous panel spoke to that. And we also know that there's the quality of the nutrients affect mental health. So really putting the head back on the body and treating the whole system is important. I would also say weight bias is a very real issue. There's a lot of judgment, and Ted shared the data from the healthcare setting, and I've been on a mission for the last 17 years to eliminate that, so I'm still on that mission, but at least now when people come into our MOBs, there's somewhere they can sit and feel safe because the chairs don't have sides or don't cater to just lower weights. I would say digital therapeutics is another big thing. It has arrived, and a lot of vendors here I would classify as digital therapeutics. There's a way that these companies are getting very sophisticated. They have good outcomes. They're able to engage because, frankly, if no one uses their product, they go out of business. So in a way, when we think about engagement, there's what you can do as a purchaser, employer. There's what we can do as a healthcare provider. And then there's the engagement of personalizing the journey for folks coming in using digital therapeutics. So I would say they can get to scale and spread, and they can get to your rural, urban, et cetera, et cetera. I would say intensive behavioral programs work. DPP works. We've been working with CDC to roll those programs out in our system for many years now. And we see more engagement and people staying in longer and getting to that gold standard of 5%. And the last thing I'll say is make sure whatever you have kind of on tap that you know you've got something and a good, strong approach to deal with failure. And I use that word kind of provocatively because we often think in the weight management space in black and white, very moral. I was bad, I was good. I was good today because I had an apple. I was bad because I went to McDonald's drive-through. I wish we could eliminate that framing because it's not healthy. It's more of a practice and revise mentality. I often think of, if any of you have been lucky enough to see a child take their first steps, you know, they're sort of stumbling and they might fall on their diapered bottom, and you're like, you're not berating them because they fell, you failed, you know, you should have kept going, what happened? You're encouraging them, you say, yay, keep going, get up, try again. And so why do we sort of suddenly turn that off when it comes to someone trying to get healthier? So the practice and revise, I think, is a really important thing for us to think about. And building in goal setting that's appropriate, so somebody's more likely to succeed, and then make it values driven. What's your why, and why does it matter to you to do it? To make that trade-off stick, because if they're choosing to go to the gym versus go out with their friends, then the values driven approach is important. And that concludes my comments. Thank you. I'm going to hand that to you.
Thank you. So it's an honor to be here, particularly as a practitioner, when you share the stage with such esteemed scholars, it can be a little intimidating. So I'm gonna start with a story, and it happened about 24 hours ago. So yesterday was one of those terrifically inspiring days that maybe is not every day, but it was a very special day for me coming home from work, and I felt great. I had a healthy dinner that I had prepared Sunday, and all I needed to do was to warm it up. So came in, started dinner, and like most of us, or like many of us, I have an occasion to check Facebook. As an American Airlines employee, one of my favorite groups is a group of about 25,000 of us that love travel. And there's always great tips and really interesting tidbits. So as I was waiting for dinner to warm, I pulled up my AA non-rev page. I have a few. And I was shocked. I went from inspired, excited, to devastated. And one of my colleagues at American had posted a photo of a morbidly obese gentleman asleep in an airport. There was no words, there was no information, but I was shocked. I mean, I was dealing with all of these emotions from going here to, and so the photo had just been posted. And as I was composing myself and what I wanted to post in response, being the wellness strategist, I knew I had to represent a lot and maybe not my anger first and foremost. And I wanted to message it appropriately. All of a sudden, messages started coming up. Immediate comments. Who are you? This is demeaning. Another comment. This could be your brother. This could be your father. This could be your next door neighbor. This could be your son. Another comment. All of a sudden, these please, please consider feelings. Do you not care about this person? Do you know how your post is being received? So by the time I had formulated my own post, over 35 responses had come in, and probably was, what, 2 minutes. So I'm still the wellness professional. I'm you know, doing my best to educate, make aware, but be caring for the person who posted it, who may or may not be aware of what was going on. And when I went to post, cannot post, has been removed. So I, by this time, I was like, well, thank goodness. I went and had dinner, needed to get back to a few things in my life. And you know, there was an election yesterday. Many of us were attuned to what was happening on the election. So as I'm getting ready to go to bed, I thought, well, I'm gonna just check one of the news sites and see who won the election. Well, my phone was still on the Facebook page. And the last post that was there was a thank you from one of these 25,000 members of this Facebook post, Facebook group, and they thanked the administrators of the group. And they said, thank you for removing it, but beyond that, thank you to all of those individuals who stood up and who cared for this person that we don't know. We have no idea who this person was. This person was asleep, or at least napping. They never even knew that this photo had been taken, or that this rage, this reaction, this emotional caring for this person, they didn't know that. But all of us received a gift because we know that we're a part of this group that cares deeply for someone that we don't know. And so I went back immediately to being inspired to know that I was such a group. I mean, in such a group. And so when I submitted this picture was a week or so ago. And the reason I selected this picture was because it does take a village. At American, we are just starting our journey. But I thought, you know, a group of superheroes. We're 85% unionized. We have over 100,000 employees. 85% of them are union. We have 5 unions, we have management, we have such talented vendors and caring culture and engaged leadership that to me, the heroes represented all that it takes to address this issue. But these heroes are those people yesterday who posted. You've seen this a couple of different ways today, but every day about 500,000 people do a very simple task, and that's to pack a suitcase or a backpack or whatever you're taking on the plane. Some of us don't think about it too much, but it's a task that we all can do. Every day we have over 1,000 nonstop air flights that take off. That's a complicated process. I think, Ted, you use the rocket scientist, mm-hmm. or the rocket science is a complicated task. But our pilots have task lists, and if you follow 1, 2, 3, 4, you can get an airplane in the air, and you can use the aerodynamic principle of lift, and it happens, you know, thousands of times every day. But there's no checklist for how do you care for someone who's fighting or that has obesity. Obesities, I love that concept. Mm-hmm. It is a complex issue that we tackle every day. Mm-hmm. And when you think about the aerodynamics of our workplace, we have hundreds of workplaces scattered around the world. We have the mental well-being aspect of 85% of our flying public fly once a year. They're going through that TSA line. They don't know what to expect. They're taken out of their element. They're out of controlled environment. There's the stresses of weather. There's the stressors of what's going to happen. They don't know what they're about to encounter. That is our environment every day for our employees. They are in the midst of engaging and being in partnership with these individuals who are stressed and who don't feel comfortable. We often see that in social media, how those experiences can take fire. The food environment. Most all of us have been in airports, and you see the lineup of offerings. As an airline, we're trying very hard to look at the foods that we have on our airplane. We're creating healthy food spaces for our employees. We're trying to look at the food environment and to see how we can support our employees in a different way, and our passengers in a different way. The physiology of working at an airline. Next time you're in the air and you see that flight attendant coming up with the beverage cart, that thing weighs 250 pounds fully loaded, and they're going against gravity, pushing it and pulling it. We have individuals who have worked for American, in fact, the average tenure of American employee is over 20 years. Our average age is 49 years of age. Think of what the physiology of lifting 50-pack luggage day after day and lifting it or putting it into aircraft. It is a very strenuous job. The physiology of working, standing on your feet if you're a gate agent or a ticket agent. There is no fitness center in an airport. Well, maybe there's one or two, but we don't have on-site fitness centers. We have concourses and terminals and ramps and runways. And then the motivation. How are we looking at motivating our employees to really gain the energy and the focus that they need to deal with the customers? As we care for our employees so they can care for you, the passengers, we really have to look at how are we removing those concerns so that presence that is needed to get our passengers safely to flight. that is their one and only concern while they're at work. So a lot is going on with our 100,000 employees. A third of us work in an airplane, pilots or flight attendants. A third of us service planes, whether that's loading your baggage, whether it is maintaining the plane. And you know, many of us, when we're flying, we pray or we ask the universe to help the pilot. I'm one of those who always thinks of the people who maintain and did maintenance on that plane. And as the flaps go up and you see all of those wires, I'm like, oh, universe, please, please have covered and have faith in the maintenance guys who did and took care of this plane, and thank you for them. And a third of us sit or stand. We're agents or we're management, and we have very sedentary jobs. So if I can click, we also have over $1 billion healthcare budget. About 8.5% of us have very complex medical exposures. We hurt. We have issues. It accounts for about 45% of our total medical spend, those 8%. We tackle issues such as obesity with a very strategic perspective. We do have bariatric surgeries for those that are working in concert with their providers and choose to go that route. For those that are dealing with at-risk or conditions that we know today as metabolic syndrome, or they want to work with a nurse, or they want to work with a dietitian, we do have condition management programs. For those and for those that are at risk, about 40% of our employees and covered members are what we consider in that yellow, that middle column, in that first bar. Over 50%, 51, 52% of us are what we consider well. And for those individuals who want to stay well, or want to age well, I'm in that category. We have lifestyle coaches. We have behavioral programs that focus on energy and resilience and how one stays mindful in the situation in which we work in. But one of the things, and this does not show well here, the entire chart doesn't show all of our strategies, but we do begin programs very small, and I believe you shared, Bruce, that you start with very small. Many of you call them pilot programs. We can't say, pilot.
Demonstration.
So we call them beta. We have betas. So we start very small, but we always have leadership involvement. Our senior leaders are our secret sauce. We just recently completed a 2-week series where we bring over 7,000 leaders into the same leadership environment. We do it over 5 days. Our CEO, our CFO, our, you know, every kind of alphabet soup you can name gets up there and they talk, and we have enthusiastic pep rallies. I wish we had recess, but we have
instant
pep rallies.
Recess, yeah.
And to have those individuals talk about our programs, our CFO shared that 12 of the senior officers completed a weight management program this past year. He put up how much weight the group had lost. He put up one of the leaders had stayed 3 years with the program. We had people lining up each of those 5 days to talk to the individuals who were involved in this digital solution. They were like personalities. They were like celebrities. To have that type of leadership, to have that type of support is so powerful. We have individuals from around our 5 union groups. And how many of you deal with unions? A few in here. It is not often that you have unions in support of their union members sending photos of themselves advocating for company programs to company intranet sites. We have unions who support their membership in engaging in our programs. They advocate, they announce our weight management programs when they're coming up. They endorse the programs because it's done in a caring way. We don't, I think several of us have talked about coming from a place of health. We talk a lot about a place of energy and focus. We don't address these programs as weight or obesity. We announce them as either wellness or health or behavioral programs. And I think that that helps enact personal stories. We oftentimes have people who will submit us letters. So at American, we have five core values. It starts with caring, it goes into collaboration, development, results, and future. Almost every day, I get an email, I get something on Facebook, I get a story, a phone call, a note from someone whose lives have changed because of our, what we in this room would call it, weight management programs, behavioral programs. One of my favorite, and I've already admitted to be a Facebook person, another group that I belong to, and I'm humbled to belong to it. One day I was on Facebook and I came across a closed group, and it was AA flight attendants in support of each other on their weight journey. And to get into the group, you had to submit what class you went in, what aircraft you fly in. There was enough information that I couldn't make up a character. There is a flight attendant called Susan Campbell. And so sometimes I can get into groups, but I didn't, I couldn't just use my name. So I thought, well, I'm Susan J. Campbell, and I work in wellness, and I would love to join the group. And they welcomed me in. So one of the groups that every day I get to tune into are 1,200 flight attendants who post encouraging things to each other. They share their battles. They share their journeys. We fly. We stay in hotels. We go on vacation. This morning there was the journey of someone who's vacationing in Mexico. And you're at a resort, enjoying the multitudinous of nutrition there, but she had been active and been walking on the beach and had gone to yoga. And there's all of this encouragement. That doesn't happen often when you're dealing with a large corporate environment. And so I have to bring it down to one thing, and that is the programs that we engage in work. This is one example of a digital solution that we use. 2 years ago, we ran our first beta with the program, and over those 2 years, we've tracked their healthcare expenditures. We're not as talented with data to track their absenteeism and their productivity at this point in time. But over those 2 years, the healthcare costs associated with those conditions and diagnoses, metabolic syndrome, for someone who completed the class, have been just under $2,000 less a year. Now, that's not a lot, but it's encouraging to know that there's engagement, activation, support that's organic, means the world to me. So we don't have the answers. We're just starting on the journey, but I do want to encourage everyone that if you come from a caring place, if you're working collaboratively together to tackle what is a very complex aim, goal, that if you come together in the right ways, with the right heart, you can begin to make a difference. And you can get the reactions that I got yesterday when I went from inspired to devastated. but that caring community took me right back up. So that is American Airlines.
Thank you. We have a few minutes for questions. Yes.
Thank you. Hi.
Hi.
I'm Dr. Ray Fabius, the medical director for the Greater Philadelphia Business Coalition on Health. And for the first two speakers, I'd love you to comment on a research that I and others have done that suggests that healthcare workers are about 10% sicker on average than the average worker. And you alluded to it because you know, you talked about they're caring, they're selfless people, and they if they have a choice in the next 15 minutes to take care of themselves or another patient, they'll take care of another patient, and we love them for that. In particular, nurses, and there's at least one study that shows that nurses, 55% of nurses are have a BMI over 30. Now, I just wanted to know whether or not, as you embarked in your programs, you identified this as well with your populations.
Yeah, in my full deck, this was a trimmed down version, I actually have a slide. The data is a little bit old now, it's from 2010. I don't think it was your research. I can't remember what the footnote is on the slide. It was, I believe, 13% was the higher utilization and cost associated with employees that worked in the healthcare industry compared to all other industries' average.
Yeah, that's after adjusting for the increase in severity. So actually, healthcare workers do set a very bad example for everybody else in the community two ways. One way, they don't take care of themselves. The other way is they don't access the healthcare system appropriately.
Correct.
So in our experience, we looked at that data as well, and the first view on the data showed our employee population, who spends a lot of time delivering care, did have poorer health indices than our member population. But I'm happy to say that the last two times we've done slices of the data, now obviously we have people who retire and people who come in, so it's not like an RCT where we can control all of that, but we have seen movement where now the profile of our population is actually healthier than our member base. Now you can also argue the ACA, a lot of members came in who were sicker, so it's not a perfect apples to apples comparison, but we have been pleased with the change in profile, and we sort of put that down to this total health incentive plan where we work with the labor management partnership. I want to say we've got 25 unions, and so we do that in partnership with them, and the dollars are real and the programs are real. And I think sometimes people can be cynical when they see this new thing on the block, but when they feel the difference, it really tends to, as you say, change the culture, and we've seen that. So we're tracking that very closely because, as you see, our vision is to have the healthiest workforce. So we're on the journey.
And many of us think that the since healthcare workers have a significant influence on family and friends, the work that the two of you are doing, not to discount the wonderful things that are going on at American, I'm a 1 million mile flyer.
Oh, wow, okay.
But you know, the work that you're doing, I think, has tremendous legs.
Thank you.
I would just add, it has an impact in the community as well, particularly, I'm not sure about Kaiser, but I know there are certain areas where Kaiser is very highly penetrated in the community work.
California.
Hawaii.
Yes.
A lot of the population is actually enrolled. And for the clinic, the same. So we actually have an influence in our community, not only as the largest employer in Cleveland, I think the second largest in the state of Ohio, but when we change the culture and the care that we're giving to our own employees, that actually percolates out to the greater community around us, and we see that.
Mm-hmm. Other question?
I thought it was really relevant that you got a larger engagement by changing, I don't think this is working, so I'll just speak, by changing the language from saying this is a weight management to the behavioral. Could you speak more on why you changed the language saying it's a wait program, and tell us more about that. I thought that was a key differential in the success you're having.
Correct. So I was recruited 3 years ago to come to American from a very small prevention research group here in the Dallas area. And from our association with some of the DPP early research work, certainly through some of the studies that I had been engaged in at the center, I knew that at the core of behavior change were just that, behaviors. And when I arrived at American, you know, company that has emerged from bankruptcy, going through a merger, there was a lot of distrust. Mm-hmm. And there was not only towards the company, but towards the vendors. So part of my initial guidance from senior leadership was to change, to make changes, to come in, use your background, develop new strategies, work with us. And so the previous programs had been very condition-based. And so I used coming from a prevention environment, I knew that we were going to go towards words such as energy, focus, well-being, wellness, and I'm pretty insistent on that. So it was, I was new. Leadership was new. The company was moving from a very hierarchical struggle to survive to a place where we did care about our futures, and more than that, we cared about delivering people safely with their baggage to their destination. So it's really become a journey for us of caring.
So while you guys search yourselves for one last question, I want to plant a question for you to answer after we get one more question, if we do, and that is, 5 years from now, what's the one thing that you see your organization doing differently with regard to obesity from today? One of our objectives is, you know, what lies ahead? And so just think about that. I'll ask for another question. Okay.
Straight
who wants to go first?
I have an aspiration, because I work on this topic every day. My hope is that in 5 years that our experience with the Medicare DPP, which in my mind in healthcare is a game changer for setting a standard on how one delivers intensive behavioral lifestyle, flows through all populations. It's not just Medicare age, but it sets the bar. It's changed where the fulcrum is about what your program needs to be. So mm-hmm. that's one thing. My other aspiration is that there's a real gap in knowledge on addressing obesity, and even within our system, we published earlier this year, actually, Ted, you were one of the co-authors, there's still a gap in knowledge on what obesity is and the complexity of it. It's still in the behavior lifestyle realm. It completely discounts the biological mechanisms that are at play. So if you just focus on calories in and out, you're missing the fact that when you have lost that weight, your hunger hormone goes up, your satiety hormone leptin goes down, your adipose cells get bigger, they're like, ooh, they're excited because the right hormone mix is there for you're hungry and you don't feel full. And then your food cues and your sensitivity to food cues goes way up. So if you were trying to do something like that today and you saw all the cookies, you're like, ooh, give me the cookies. So my hope is that more and more of our clinicians get board certified in obesity medicine, and then the more people that understand the complexities of obesity, then we really change the fulcrum on the nature of care. That's my aspiration in 5 years.
That's very good. I would agree with all of that, some of which I would have said. But for us, we are actually embarking on a second journey now, because we're getting a lot of data back from our own employee health plan on those non-pilot studies that we're doing. studies that we're doing about what may work and what may not work. We're now trying to leverage that beyond the 105,000 employees and their families to the 1.8 million patients that the clinic sees every year. So what we've had at the clinic is a bunch of really, really bright people scattered across, you know, 80 different medical centers, all figuring out the best way to do something that has the same endpoint, which is how do we manage to work with obesity, treat obesity, get people to lose weight and keep it off. They haven't really been talking to one another. So we've just started the process of getting all these people into a room and saying, hey, we literally did a survey and said, hey, we've got like 85 different programs. They're all a little bit different. Some are working better than others. Let's sit down and figure out how to make one program, not one size fits all, but one umbrella program that can identify which of the obesity's population, it goes right back to that, which segment of the obese population will respond best to this intervention, which segment will respond best to that intervention, and how do we get that data and distribute it, distribute the patients to the programs. That's my hope for 5 years from now, so we have more effective results than we do now.
Right.
Susan, you get to close us.
Oh, goodness. Oh. I think that my hope for 5 years at American Airlines is those 40% or so of us at American that are engaged in our help take over the airline, and we infuse the airline to become the airline you want to fly on if health and well-being is your priority, and you know that from the time you enter that terminal that you're going to be cared for. And every opportunity, the environment that you enter, the individuals you encounter are there to support you.
Great.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, everybody.
Wow.
Thank you.
It's
a pleasure.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah.
And we're going to talk about mental health.
What a great panel. And first, I'm going to just build on your last. Wouldn't it be great if every business was thinking exactly that way? That all of us were thinking as part of that community, our piece of this very complex and difficult puzzle. You know, there were a couple of parallels between our Healthy Minds conference and our obesity conference today. You know, we heard one, leadership, two, science. The science, what we know today in the last 5-10 years is light years more than we knew 25 years ago. We also hear emerging practices that are starting to move the dime, some of which people assume people know about and they don't, right? And we really need to kind of keep our foot to the pedal moving forward. I think we have the right leaders in the room to help us do that. There's leaders outside this room that we need to get to, and it's incumbent upon all of us to share in that burden to get there. So we've got a great two more sessions tomorrow. We're starting with caregiving, which I think is one of the emerging, I think, as one of the key and most hot topics in our benefits world and also in the corporate world, too. And I think we have to, I'm really looking forward to that. And then some of the themes we heard today, and Ray, you're going to lead us off tomorrow, and we're going to hear from Prudential and others talking about culture and community, which we know, again, we heard a lot of those themes earlier today, but I think what we're learning is what actually works, right? We have a lot of activity. The question is what activity actually works, and we're going to hear more about that tomorrow.